session number 215.52, rule 5.
Raymond Venables, Reel 5. So what happened when you got to Malta?
That's a very good question. We were all thinking, gosh, we'll go ashore and have a look at Malta and so on. Not on your life. We went in, to begin with, the entire population turned out to cheer us in because Mussolini said another ship would never arrive there. It was an extraordinary sight. Then we went alongside and so far from going ashore, we then... after this lot, had to unload all that ammunition. So we worked like nobody's business. And as soon as we finished, we turned around, came out again, and came back zigzagging vigorously, and all at action stations back to Gibraltar. So we never saw anything in Malta except Valletta Harbour.
Were there any Italian attacks on the way back?
No, there weren't. I mean, they might have tried, but, you know, they didn't. I mean, it was... mostly in the dark. We came back fast and, you know, I don't think they certainly, U-boats wouldn't attack a zigzagging cruiser particularly. I shouldn't think they wouldn't be wise.
Why would that be?
Well, I mean, because it's not an easy target. I mean, don't forget the Queen Elizabeth and the Queen Mary crossed the Atlantic unescorted because of their speed and they worked out zigzags, which... probably meant that a U-boat could hardly have managed to sink them.
Is that because of the timing of the torpedo, by the time the torpedo...
Yes, and the time it takes to get there, the difficulty of getting into position so you can fire it. I mean, we spent, you know, even with great convoys and the escorts, you spent your whole life zigzagging. And these zigzags were carefully worked out so that it made it more difficult for the... So when they were in wolf packs of about 30, that was different. But, I would have been surprising if we had been attacked on the way back, except by aircraft, perhaps.
So you arrived back in Gibraltar. What happened next?
We went, and then we almost immediately set off, and instead of going back to England, which we hoped, we set off down to Cape Town. And lazily, you know, with in those waters, it was fine. We went down to Cape Town.
Were you on your own? Was Edinburgh on its own at that time?
Yes, I think we were. Or what did we might have escorted some things as far as Freetown. I can't quite remember.
And what was the purpose of going to South Africa?
There was obviously something, but... they didn't always tell ordinary seamen what the whole purpose of the exercise was. I remember the most extraordinary, because the real incidents that matter to people are, not necessarily to do with the conduct of the war. The thing I most remember on that long, lazy float down to Cape Town was a destroyer appeared on the horizon, winked at us vigorously, got mail for you. And they came alongside and there were 30 letters from Madame. I think I bought a whole bunch of bananas somewhere in exchange for an old shirt. And one of my memories of myself is reading 30 letters from my wife, or my fiancé in those days, and eating a whole bunch of bananas at the same time. And learning, and this is what that war was like, extraordinarily, that she was a Wren in Lowestoft where she'd been machine gunned in the street because these nuisance bombers and fighters came over and a lot of bombing. And there was I with my feet up, sitting by my gun and eating bananas and reading her letters. As far as risk went, you know, well, it's quite risky going through the Med, but it was nasty. And then later she was in Liverpool and she was bombed. So it was it evened things up a bit as between the men and the women.
What was the importance of mail?
Well, infinite. I mean, if you were in love, particularly. I mean, it mattered. It was more than anything. Then it was simply contact with civilization, as distinct from what isn't civilization. And it's very important. I found myself writing to three or four prisoners of war and getting letters from them, because they were old friends of mine who were prisoners, and there was a system. I've still got their letters somewhere. They, you know, a form, really, and you write a few things. But it it did matter hugely.
Did that increase with the war, or I'm thinking of the contrast between pre-war and wartime. I mean, obviously it was a generation where people wrote more letters.
Mm.
But did the war increase letter writing, do you feel?
Well, I mean, it increased the need for it, because you couldn't pick up the telephone. Not that we in our generation did very much. We used to write letters, war or no war. But the fact that you were aware, apart from each other all this time, I mean, my wife always says, really, it's time you burnt those. But there's a whole trunk full of my letters to her and her letters to me. I can't quite bring myself to burn them.
And what would happen if somebody didn't receive mail? Would that be a problem, or would it be recognised as a problem?
Well, I mean, yes, in both senses, that, you know, people's relationships did bust up, and letters would stop, and then there were other people who would feel rather sad because they hadn't got anyone to write letters to them. All of that.
I've heard of cases where people would share their mail or allow their shipmates to read mail if they didn't have any.
Yes, no, I never did that, I must say. And I got a few other letters. My brothers, we used to write to each other, but nothing like so much as the love of my life.
So what happened when you arrived in South Africa?
Well, that was when we had this South African admiral called Seyfried. My gather is a big South African name, and he was vice admiral, I think. And he said, you lot have been at sea for a long time, and I think you need a good 48 hours leave. And so he fixed up for all of us, everybody, to go, as the sailors used to put it, up Omas. We didn't quite go up Omas. We went, our host was the owner of a luxury hotel, a place called Musenberg, just down the coast. And about four of us went there, and were most royally entertained. And in the evening, we decided we'd go out and have a meal. And we hadn't been eating terribly well for a bit. And so we had an absolutely slap-up meal. And we just ordered the cigars and the liqueurs and things at the end of it. And then we said, my God, you know. And we haven't spent much of our pay, but it's going to equal this. And we asked the waiter for the bill. He said, there isn't any bill. I said, well, why not? He said, well, there's a rich old lady who lives in Musenberg, and she said, if any British sailors come in, give them what they want and send the bill to me. And it was really a greedy little boy's dream. But it's an act of generosity I haven't ever forgotten.
So what was the behaviour of the civilians like in South Africa then?
Well, they were, I mean, the behaviour, I was already profoundly shocked by their behaviour towards black people. It was awful. But their behaviour to us, of course, was very welcoming.
Did you see any instances of their behaviour towards black people? Towards black people?
Yes. Well, I mean, you only got to look at the buses. I went where, you know, you had to sit in a different place, except that a friend and I, he had the splendid name of Prophet, and he was a newspaper man for the Scotsman, and we went ashore together, and we went and, you know, deliberately sat in the non-white bits, but it wasn't a particularly good idea, because the non-white didn't want us to, so we gave it up. But the people we met socially, of course, were all white, and the way they talked horrified, at any rate, Prophet and me.
And how long were you there at the
We were in there for, I can't really remember, perhaps about a week. And they were extraordinarily kind to us, and it is a lovely place. There's one other thing. We were in Simonstown, just along the coast, big naval base, and there was a bit oddity of naval history, which I happened to see. There was a dog which travelled on the train between Cape Town and Simonstown, which liked sailors. So it used to get in a carriage with sailors. It got named Able Seaman, and it was called Able Seaman Nuisance. And he quite celebrated this hound, and I did travel one trip from Muesenberg, from Simonstown to Cape Town, with Able Seaman Nuisance in the carriage. And he when you talk to South Africans who'd come from there, they vaguely remember this.
What type of dog was Able Seaman Nuisance?
Yes, they made the dog an Able Seaman because it obviously had this pleasure in the company of sailors.
So, what did you do after you left South Africa? Where did you go to next?
We went back up to Gibraltar and did another convoy.
Can you tell me about that, step by step?
I don't know that I can tell you about the difference, because it seemed very similar and perhaps they get merged in my memory. What I can tell you is the night we got to Gibraltar and we heard we were going through again on the next day was the one night in my life when I have been most frightened, because it's this business of feeling you can do that once but you can't get away with it twice. There's no reason in this, but that night, which was very beautiful, sunset, it really did cross my mind, but it didn't very often, that, you know, it might just conceivably be my last night on earth. But as soon as we sailed, it didn't cross your mind at all. Yeah, you were doing something, going somewhere, adrenaline pumped. But the day before, it's rather like, you know, waiting to go into bat with a nasty fast bowler and a bumpy pitch.
Did you manage to reconcile your feelings before you sailed, or was it just as you got sailing?
You just had them. You didn't do anything about them. I mean, you know, you didn't in those days. You didn't have therapists and people to tell you how to. What we did, there's no doubt, is the method was simply to pretend that you weren't frightened. I remember it was on that convoy, I think, that they came on and said, they kept us informed. They said, 120 torpedo bombers have just taken off from Sicily or something. So go to action station, blow up your, put on your tin hats. And I could remember a rather bored fellow ordinary seaman saying, called Kitching, I seem to remember. And he said, then? Did he say dive bombers or torpedo bombers? I rather think he said torpedo bombers. And of course it was a pose, but some poses are as useful as others. And the English way of pretending you're not frightened and this helps you not to be is just one method.
You mentioned that you were given a commentary. How did that come about? Was that on a tannoy or system? Or?
Yes. It was this chap, Fitzroy Talbot, of whom I have vivid memories, who was later, I think, a vice admiral. He sat on the top of the directors, you know, the gun directors, on the top of the swivel chair. And he would start off. He used to remind us of sort of Howard Marshall doing a test match. Lovely day up here, you know. And he said, you might have noticed the Hermione has been detached off eastwards, and you'll be glad to hear she's gone to blow the pants off Pater Maria. And this kind of thing. He was a joke figure, but he was quite good fun.
Did that help with morale?
Oh, enormous. Because that went right down to the stokers. Everyone could hear it. And he was very good at, keeping your spirits up.
Because you mentioned earlier that earlier on, you hadn't really known what you were doing as an organ.
I mean, with the general strategic thing, you knew nothing. But if you were immediately about to be attacked by something, well, they let you know that pretty well.
Was that a common practice on other ships, or would it?
Yes, I think always. I think they, if they had any sense, they certainly would. And also, but you also had to have the equipment. Now I think of it, I'm not sure whether a small ship you could do it quite so well.
Would it be a tannoy system that ran throughout the ship?
Yes, and particularly, I remember particularly that they particularly had in mind the stokers, because but down there, you know, it's not funny if you've no idea what's going on.
Is there any incidents that you remember on that convoy? Specifically, of anything from the... You said they merged together, but is there anything that specifically stands out?
I certainly can't sort of pick out different episodes from the two. They're only a few weeks apart. And, you know, sometimes I think I could be absolutely certain which one... I could look it up, because I've got which one the Fearless was sunk in, which one the Manchester was damaged in. I half wondered whether I was on the one where they got the Ohio in, but I wasn't. I discovered that.
With the Italian attacks, say the torpedo attacks, how long would an attack take from the start of it to really that you saw the last plane disappearing?
Not long, because after all they were not far from their bases, and you heard they were coming, and when they came, because they got them... By then, we had slightly better radar, or any case, we knew they were coming. And they came in one, the torpedo bombers, as far as I remember, came in one wave of attack, and that was that. And they went off again. So it's a question of minutes rather than hours, even.
And how many rounds would your gun be able to get off if they attacked?
I can't remember. You know, it was an awful lot, but... the number of rounds, I can't think. There was quite a lot of cartridge cases lying down around.
And you mentioned on the early one that one of the torpedo bombers was shot down.
Mm.
What type of weapon on the ship sank, shot the...
That I can't be sure. It's probably the Oricon guns, because they were, you know, when they're really low, our guns were 4-inch, and you weren't very likely to hit low-flying ones. But the Oricons were, and also those 8-barrel pom-poms, you know, pom 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 pom. And there was one of those, as it happens, just above my gun, so that they were water cooled. And I remember when they were going, the water dripped on you.
So, what was most effective against the different types of attack? Would the Oricons and the pom pom guns be most effective against the torpedo bombers? What about the 4-inch gun? What would that be most effective?
Well, against? More against the high level bombers. Because there were also 6-inch guns, and they weren't high level at all. They weren't anti-aircraft. Not in that ship. In the Hermione and her class, they were extraordinary. I think they were 5.25s, and they were extraordinary because they, instead of being like this all the time, you could see them doing this.
So they could virtually raise themselves vertically.
Yes, the main armament in the Dido, the Hermione, the Phoebe, that lot, they were both HA and LA, whereas in the Edinburgh and the Belfast, I mean, those 6-inch guns on the Belfast, whatever the biggest are, 6-inch, yes, they couldn't fire at aircraft. And I suppose it means that, you know, the cruiser, I suppose, was redesigned, you know, at the beginning of the war or during the first days of the war, so that the main armament, when they realised the chief enemy were aircraft and going to be, that the main armament could take on aircraft as well as the secondary armament.
So what happened when you got to Malta the second time?
Same thing. We just unloaded and bolted back again, quick.
So what happened when you got back to Gibraltar?
Well, one thing I remember is that we sailed in and... In those days, big ships carried a band, and as we were there, we got in first, and the Renown came in, I think she was the Renown, with the Marines on the quarterdeck and the band all out, and he raised his baton. We thought he'd be playing Rule Britannia or something, and what he played was a stupid song, which, "Oh, what a surprise for the Duce," we all roared in laughter. It was quite absurd. It's one of those sort of songs, like "We're going to hang out our washing on the Siegfried Line." It was one of those would-be funny songs, which was, in those circumstances, quite funny.
And I take it morale must have been good, that you felt that you'd got the convoys through.
Yes, it was, yes. There's no doubt. I mean, when the fleet came out, we went off with another cruiser and the Rodney and the Nelson, but they were so slow, they were dropping us down. And we were pursuing Italian battleships, and which is not a very sensible thing to do. They're better armed. But I can remember personally hoping we would catch them. And I'm now saying that I'm here, and I'm glad we didn't. But at the time, something operates in the bloodstream or something.
With something like that, you said the Italian fleet returned to port rather than engage you during the convoys. What was your general impression about the Italian Navy?
Well, my feeling was that they were pretty sensible not to take on the Rodney and the Nelson. It had the biggest guns of any ships afloat. There was a feeling too that the Italians were not so eager for battle as other people. And then we would say, "And would you be if you were dragged into this lot by that bloody lot of Hitlerian?" And there was a certain amount of feeling that the eye ties this and the eye ties that. But on the other hand, when you come to think of it, if Britain had been hijacked into the war the way the Italians would, I certainly would have been on my way home as soon as possible. And the fact was that when you've got prisoners, Italian prisoners, I only saw one, but of course they were more delighted than the Germans to be out of it, and many of them came to England and have been here ever since as farmers or something. So there was a difference in their morale and their fighting spirit, but it's a perfectly understandable one because they've got no business in that war.
So what did you perceive as the greatest threat in the Mediterranean when you were in Edinburgh?
We weren't there for long. I mean, if you asked, H-Force, as it was called, was just an ad hoc thing which came when it was necessary. I dare say the others would find more trouble with Italian submarines, who were very active. But really, I think aircraft with such close bases, you know, the aircraft, when they can bring fighters with them and so on, it must have been the worst. But after all, our chief threat to them were submarines, working out of Alexandria mostly, and it was the chief battle. I mean, ours were special ones to Malta, but the chief battle was how to stop Rommel being fortified in North Africa. And then ports of Malta, was, of course, it was an unsinkable aircraft carrier stuck in the middle there.
Did you understand the importance of that at the time?
Oh, yes. Yes, we all knew that. We all knew that there was a time when they got three aircraft, Gloucester Gladiators, called Faith, Hope and Charity. But we were delighted because when we got some Spitfires to them and some Spitfire materials. So there was a lot of genuine feeling about Malta, yes.
And by this time, obviously, you'd survived two Malta convoys.
Yeah.
How did you personally feel about it? Were you adjusting to Navy life by that stage?
Oh, yes. I mean, in a funny way. I mean, what astonished me is how you take it all for granted from the very beginning. It always surprises me looking back on it. You know, you're a student deep in his books and his sport one minute, with your girl, and a few weeks later you're living an extraordinarily different life. And the fact is that it's not as surprising as all that. You sort of do it. It's very mysterious to me, too.
So what happened after you arrived back in Gibraltar?
Then we came back to England. I think we went pretty straight. Yes, we went up the Clyde and anchored at Gourock. And by then, I had had a brief interview with the captain and the commander to decide whether I was fit material. I always remembered that because I had a very nice petty officer who I was working under him, and he said, "The captain wants to see you." And I said, "Oh, does he? Thank you, P.O. He said, "You're not going to be an officer, are you?" I said, "I shouldn't think so." "Well, you be a good one, mate. I think you will be a good one." I was very pleased with him. He's a lovely chap. He didn't mind. I always thought it was slightly ludicrous to become an officer when there were people there who had been in the Navy since I was born and knew more about everything. But they didn't think it was ludicrous, so I accepted it.
How had you gone about that? Had you applied to be an officer?
No. I think what happened, as I said, I think if you got a university degree, you were prima facie possible. Because if you could learn one thing, you could presumably learn another. I mean, I got somewhere. It's very interesting because, I found a picture of my passing out course, and I sent it to my wife with a letter, which I also survived, making one or two comments about them. An awful lot of them were school teachers. And school teachers have done some training, and so school teachers are likely to be able to mop up whatever they have to learn quickly. And this was it. It wasn't a question of social class or anything like it. It had nothing to do with that.
So how did you hear about it? What happened? Were you just invited?
I think I knew right from the start that this was on your papers and you went to see, and but you never mentioned it to anybody. You kept very quiet about it. And I didn't see why it should happen. I was not one of those who said, I said to once, very annoying people, when they found she was a Wren officer, they say, "Oh, I never took my commission." My commission? Nobody's got a commission. I mean, and I never took the view that I was by nature. I was rather surprised when anybody thought I would make one. But that's how one thought about it.